Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. British Home Secretary Charles Clarke confirmed today what London police have been saying clearly off the record. London's bombers last week were suicide bombers. They blew themselves up, said Clarke today, along with scores of Londoners and, he might have added, along with a comforting presumption that suicide terror was someone else's problem. Now the scourge of Israel and Iraq has come to the heart of London in the form of homegrown killers ready to die. Achieving security in the UK and the US just got a lot more difficult. Tonight on Point, homegrown suicide terror in the heart of the West. We begin tonight in London with the latest on the investigation into last Thursday's attacks and British reaction. In the House of Commons today, Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke about the extremism that motivated the attackers.
This is not an isolated criminal act we are dealing with. It is an extreme and evil ideology whose roots lie in a perverted and poisonous misinterpretation of the religion of Islam.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. I asked him to outline the British government's emerging response to the revelation that last week's attacks were apparently carried out by British nationals, suicide bombers.
It's twofold, really. In the first place, I guess what you'd kind of expect, and it's in a way the easy bit, is the legal and police response. And that is to say that the government will, in the coming days and months, put forward legislation that they hope will help in stamping out this kind of stuff. And the kind of things we'll include will be fairly uncontroversial things, really, such as refusing entry to any Muslim cleric who wanted to come in the into the country and preach insightful, hateful things, and also to deport any foreign clerics who were in Britain doing similar things. I mean, there are lots of other things involved on the legislative side. They want to come up with a new offence, which would be acts preparatory to terrorism. Now, that is important because, by and large, British law and American law is kind of similar. It's easy to prosecute people once an offence has been committed, but it's much more difficult to prosecute people for things that they're plotting to do but haven't yet done. But the more interesting thing is Tony Blair, his government, and indeed Britain in general, trying to kind of reach forward to get more to the roots of this problem. And Tony Blair has said that there needs to be a debate, which the government will have with the Muslim community in Britain, but one which he said that the Muslim community really needs to have with itself to stamp out the ideology that leads to people doing these dreadful acts that happened last week.
And what's he proposing for that? What British Home Secretary Charles Clarke, also talking about this today, saying Britain has to stand out in a very strong way against anybody who preaches this kind of fundamentalism. He said we have to attack the people who are driving it, organizing it, manipulating these people. What is Tony Blair suggesting when it comes to getting to this root? How's that done?
Well, to be fair, I think, Tom, they're still reaching, touching, and feeling in the dark. Because you've got to understand, this is one of the biggest crises to affect any British government in a long time.
Yes.
Step back from this for a minute. I mean, this is the first case of a suicide bombing in Western Europe. It's the first case in Britain, and it involved British-born people. Now, this is clearly a major shock to the system. Now, the initial reaction of the British government has been to say, yes, let's have this debate. But interestingly, they've been talking about the need for everyone to stand up and not to be complacent about the values that make Britain what it is. And that's often a bit more of a problem in this country than it is in the United States, because people often scratch their heads and say, well, you know, what is it to be British? Well, the British government is saying it's free market economics, it's freedom of speech, and the general accoutrements, if I could put it that way, of a Western liberal democracy.
That is, in part, civil liberties which may be challenged in the effort to deal with this problem. Rob, anything more learned about the four bombers who, at this point, are, I guess, all believed to have killed themselves or have died in the bombings in any case?
Not a huge amount on the fourth bomber. I think it's pretty clear that the police now know who all four of them were. They were all from a West Yorkshire area in the north of England, an area that has a large Muslim population. Of course, all sorts of anecdotal evidence is coming out about some of the individuals who've been named. Their friends saying, I don't understand it, I played cricket with this guy, he was very polite. The kind of things that you've heard before whenever there have been suicide bombings or people involved in dreadful acts where their neighbours turn around and say, I just don't get it. But in a way, it's the fact that the neighbours just don't get it, which seems to explain how these people slipped by and large under the radar of Britain's intelligence services.
We read of the uncle of one of the alleged bombers, Shahzad Tanweer. This is Bashir Ahmed, 65 years old, saying that young bomber's family has been left shattered by the news. But Tanweer reportedly studied religion in Pakistan recently, a kind of flag.
Well, possibly so. And you know, I think that one of the focuses of the investigation from now on in will be to look at where did these young men travel to and who did they meet on their travels. We know that he went to Pakistan. There are also reports another one of these individuals went to Pakistan. So that's what Britain's intelligence services are doing now, and the police are trying to track down where did they go, who did these people know, were there other people involved. But you know, the really interesting thing is that, you know, this idea that you can say, aha, this person has the classic background of an Islamic extremist, you know, this just goes to show how difficult it is to say that. You know, this guy that you're talking about, he went to a university, he often dressed in Western-style clothing. You can see the kind of task that the intelligence agencies are up against.
A French minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, saying that some, at least, of these bombers had been arrested before and let go in a bid to catch a wider network, also claiming that the suspected explosives in the case came from the Balkans or Eastern Europe. How's the British government responding to those assertions?
Well, as to the arrests, a categorical denial, and it came pretty quick, pretty ferocious, pretty fast. Because this would have been hugely embarrassing if the British government had to say, well, in fact, we had been kind of watching these people. They had come through our clutches, mm-hmm. but that they were then released and went off to carry out these acts. Now, the British government has had to row back a little bit, saying security sources saying that they think that two of these bombers had, in fact, come into contact with the police before, but for minor criminal actions, not for national security issues.
And the search for a fifth person or a mastermind, any progress?
Well, we know that the police are looking for a fifth person. They haven't said very much about this person, except that they don't think that he was a suspected bomber, but that he is wanted for questioning in connection with the attacks. Now, as for this whole issue of mastermind, I'm not sure that that's the right word, but here's the deal. On balance, the security services, investigators looking into this, they just don't quite think that these people did this all on their own. They haven't got any conclusive evidence, they say at this point, but they just feel that there was probably outside help. Now, not entirely clear whether that outside help meant other British citizens or people overseas.
And Rob, finally, you alluded earlier, but it's just breathtaking to see the breadth of crisis that this could present to the UK. You have a very large Muslim community. It's tied into a European community, which is tied now, we're told, into the course of the Middle East and Iraq. How deep, how broad, how long a crisis do you think you're headed into here?
I think it is a huge crisis for Britain, but of course it is part of a wider crisis about Islamic violent extremism, and you could say that this is the issue of the beginning of the 21st century, no doubt about it. But to stick to Britain, this is a huge problem, and people are grappling with it, because not surprisingly, people are asking themselves, how did this happen? How could people who were born and raised in this country commit such an atrocity against fellow citizens? And I don't think anybody thinks that there are any easy answers to this, not the British government, not ordinary British people, not the smart people who write columns in newspapers, and not the leaders of Britain's Muslim community. Everybody is feeling their way in the dark a bit here.
Rob Watson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from London. We are talking tonight about the London attacks that now appear to be the first case of homegrown suicide terrorism in Britain, in Western Europe. You can join the conversation. When you first heard the news of the attacks, did you suspect suicide? Did you expect that they would be young, Muslim, and British? And what is the right answer, the effective answer, to suicide terror? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8225. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, Robert Pape.
Thanks for having me.
You've put a thesis out there, controversial in many quarters, that it's not Islamic fundamentalism, but what you describe as U.S. occupation of Muslim countries that's provoking suicide terror. Does your thesis hold up in this London bombing, Professor?
I think it mainly does. The London attacks are part of al-Qaeda's strategic logic, which they have been pursuing with increasing vigor since 9/11. Since 2002, al-Qaeda has carried out over 15 suicide and other terrorist attacks, killing nearly 700 people, more than all the years before 9/11 combined. Although many have hoped that U.S. counterterrorism efforts would have weakened al-Qaeda, the facts show that by the measure that counts, the ability of al-Qaeda to kill us, al-Qaeda is stronger now than before 9/11.
But these were not Iraqis or Palestinians or even Saudis who had U.S. forces in their country before, or Lebanese. They were Britons.
Of the 71 al-Qaeda suicide terrorists, that is from 1995 to early 2004, there were 71 al-Qaeda suicide terrorists who actually killed themselves to carry out Osama's attacks. Over two-thirds came from Sunni Muslim countries where the United States has stationed forces. The other one-third are truly transnational in nature. That is, they didn't come specifically from those countries. However, they were very powerfully motivated by the main goal of al-Qaeda, which is to compel the United States and other Western states to withdraw military forces from the Arabian Peninsula. This group, the al-Qaeda group that claimed responsibility for these attacks just 2 hours after the attacks, almost the same time Blair was talking about them himself, said specifically, these attacks in London were to punish Britain for their military operations in Iraq, and then went on to threaten Italy and Denmark with suicide terrorist attacks.
Two of the countries that have had troops in Europe. Robert Pape, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about homegrown suicide terror in the heart of the West. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about homegrown suicide terror in the heart of the West and what it means. You can join us tonight. How are you absorbing the implications of London's suicide bombings? Can any nation be secure against this kind of threat within? And why suicide? Why not just leave the bombs and walk off the train? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight by Robert Pape at the University of Chicago. He's director of the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism and author of Dying to Win. We're joined now from Washington by Peter Bergen, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden. Peter Bergen, thank you for joining us.
Good evening.
Your interpretation of the fact that these were suicide bombings apparently in London and not a simpler form of attack. Why?
Well, it's not the first time that British citizens have engaged with suicide terrorism. 2 years ago, two second-generation middle-class British Pakistani descent walked into a jazz club in Tel Aviv, mm-hmm. and one of them blew themselves up. And, of course, if Richard Reid hadn't had this case of cold feet on the American Airlines flight from Paris to Miami, clearly the shoe bombing attempt would have been a suicide operation. So it's not sort of that surprising because it's already happened in Israel, British citizens, and it almost happened on an American Airlines flight between Paris and Miami.
We'll look at the motivations, the roots, but just in simple terms, let me put the same question to you I put to our listeners. Why in this case? It seems almost deliberately sacrificial. Couldn't these men have, I mean, all these bombs went off just after trains had left the station. Why didn't they get off at the station and just leave the bags on? Why
well,
suicide?
Yeah, they may, you know, I mean, there is a very powerful ideology of martyrdom that exists amongst these people, and clearly I suspect that these, at least one or two of these people probably trained in Kashmir, picked up these ideas of suicide attacks and sort of exported them back to England.
And what do you see as the security implications for the United States, Peter Bergen, of now, yes, suicide bombers before who were British, but now successful and in the heart of London? Is there a washover effect for the U.S. to be watching?
Well, you know, the popular conception is that a bunch of nutcases from sort of Islamist madrasas in the Middle East are attacking us, and of course that's not true. There's a lot of data to show that most of the attacks on the, directed at the United States or other Western targets are conducted by European nationals. And the corollary of that is that we should look at our visa waiver program we have with these countries, which allows British passport holders and other European country passport holders to come into the country very easily, and sort of say, is there something we need to fix here? I'm not suggesting we scrap the program; that would be completely unmanageable and would alienate many of our key allies. But you know, the fact is that the Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, was British, and we've seen Omar Sheikh, the guy who killed Danny Pearl, was also British. And we've seen a number of very radicalized British citizens, but it's not peculiar simply to Britain. It's a pan-European problem. It's true in Spain, it's true in Germany, it's true in Italy, it's true in Holland.
Just so we understand, today, legally, if these four young men in the UK had wanted to get on a flight to New York or Washington or L.A., could they simply have done it? They just present their British passport, the visa's automatic, and over they come?
Yeah, I mean, they've got to apply for a visa, but it's not, they don't have to apply there's no face-to-face interview. There's no interview with a consular official. If you apply for a visa as a Pakistani national, you're almost certainly going to have to go to the embassy and meet with an embassy official to come to the United States. That's not true for the many countries we have visa waiver programs with, and particularly, of course, in Europe. And in fact, of course, 9/11 very much benefited from that, because Saudi citizens benefited from the visa waiver program.
And Peter Bergen, what about the roots and motivation here? Robert Pape's been making a lot of noise with his thesis lately. I'm sure you've looked at it. He says this isn't about Islamic fundamentalism. This is about occupation of Muslim territory. How do you read the roots, the motivation behind these attacks?
Well, you know, I've been reading Professor Pape's book, and I've been really enjoying it. He's coming up with a sort of unified field theory of terrorism, which, of course, the attacks on Thursday, I think, actually don't quite fit in with his schemata, because obviously American troops are not occupying, and the people doing this aren't protesting some kind of American occupation in the same way that people in Iraq are. I mean, it's just something slightly different. I'm not disagreeing with his point that so many of these attacks are aimed at democracies and are aimed at places where the American occupation of Iraq clearly excites the jihadists. However, I mean, I think the religious dimension can't be taken away. You know, you asked the question, why do these people want to martyr them or commit suicide? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there is this whole raft of ideas about martyrdom and the 72 virgins and stuff, and people really believe this. So I think the 9/11 hijackers, for instance, saw what they were doing as an act of worship. If you look at the kinds of documents that were found in Muhammad Atta's luggage, these people really inhabit the 7th century. They see themselves as companions of the Prophet Muhammad. They award themselves names based on early Islamic heroes. This is not just protesting foreign occupation, it seems to me. This has got a very strong religious dimension as well.
Robert Pape, speak to that, if you would. It does seem, as I look at your thesis, to the extent I understand it, and what's going on in London, it doesn't seem to be a perfect fit here. You wrote earlier, the data show that there is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism. And yet, as Peter Bergen says, we see at least a lot of inspiration or psychological support being drawn from an extremist reading of the Quran.
Since 1980, I studied a number of democratic occupations, all the occupations that led to suicide terrorism and all those that did not lead to suicide terrorism. What I found is an important difference between those democratic occupations that did and did not lead to suicide terrorism. Those that led to suicide terrorism also involved a religious difference between the foreign occupier and the local community. Not only a religious difference between, say, Christianity and Islam, or between Judaism and Islam, but even in Sri Lanka, where the Tamil Tigers are using suicide terrorism and have used suicide terrorism, where their opponents are the Sinhalese, who are Buddhists. The reason that religious difference matters is because it enables the terrorist leader, like Osama bin Laden, to portray the foreign state as the foreign occupier as having religiously motivated goals. And that then leads to his rhetoric of calling us crusaders and asserting that we have a crusader-like mission on the Arabian Peninsula. Well, as a result of that discussion of religion, it is the case in Al-Qaeda that about one-third of the suicide terrorists from Al-Qaeda truly fit a transnational model, many of whom are motivated by religion, but what's underneath it, the pivot, the center of gravity, if you would, at the root of it is mainly opposition to those imperial policies that are best depicted by those physical presence of combat forces on the Arabian Peninsula.
Robert Pape, I have to interrupt just for a moment. We know that you're not a fan of U.S. troops being on the ground in the Middle East. You like, what's it called, offshore power protection, offshore balancing, that is.
That's right, but that's not a position I've held before I studied suicide terrorism. That's simply what I think is our best long-term policy to secure our access to oil in the Middle East.
But roundabout, are you saying if we want to stop suicide terror, we have to get out of the very countries that U.S. troops are in? Is this a roundabout way of critiquing the Iraq War, or?
No, it's not a roundabout way of critiquing the Iraq War. It's coming to ask the central question, what are our core vital interests in the Persian Gulf, and what is our best long-term strategy for achieving it? Our core vital interest in the Persian Gulf is not micromanaging the domestic politics of Muslim societies. Our core vital interest in the Persian Gulf is access to oil. That's why we're there, not in Africa and not in South America. Well, we have an alternative strategy to secure that interest, an alternative to permanent onshore combat presence, and that alternative strategy is offshore balancing. In the 1970s and 1980s, the United States secured its interest in oil in the Persian Gulf without stationing a single combat soldier there.
This is having troops on ships on bases near the region, just going in emergencies.
Yes. And what that strategy, which involved an alliance with Iraq and Saudi Arabia, which we can do again, which relied on naval aircraft carriers off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula, and naval air power now is more effective than in the past, and which relied, as you said, on bases on the peninsula so that we could rapidly deploy hundreds of thousands of ground combat troops in a crisis, that strategy worked splendidly against Saddam Hussein and his aggression against Kuwait in 1990, and is again our best strategy to secure our long-term interest in oil while preventing the rise of suicide terrorists from coming at us, because that will take away the main mobilization appeal of Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders.
Peter Bergen, I wish you'd look at this at two levels, and first, not to be quite so far from what's happened in London. I mean, there's the security level presented here and the strategic level that Robert Pape is speaking to. At the security level, what's the fresh host of challenges that are brought to bear when you've got suicide terror as opposed to any other kind?
Well, you know, suicide attacks are just so much more deadly. I mean, as Pape has demonstrated in his book, I mean, the reason that people use suicide attacks is they're strategically successful. And we've seen in Iraq, the foreign fighters who are conducting most of these attacks have, you know, they've got the United Nations to withdraw. They've got pretty much every international aid organization to withdraw. They've made life for Westerners in Iraq almost untenable. And they are having strategic successes using this. So this, I mean, that's why people use this. But I wanted to respond to a few things that have just come up.
Please.
On the one hand, I totally agree with Professor Pape. I mean, if you ask Osama bin Laden why he's doing what he's doing, the very first statement he made after 9/11, he talked about the humiliation we felt for the last 60 years. Now, that reference, I'm sure, blew past most listeners. But what he was referring to was the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, which had secretly carved up the Middle East, mm-hmm. and then the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, for him, this is almost like for Hitler, the Versailles Treaty was a stab in the back, and it was this feeling of national humiliation.
Right.
We know that these feelings of humiliation are very powerful and can change the way the world happens. And I agree on that level. On the other hand, you know, part of Professor Pape's thesis is that our presence in certain countries provokes these reactions. But, you know, we have troops in Djibouti where there's not this reaction. We have troops in Colombia where there's not this reaction. We've had troops for 50 years in Okinawa, in Japan, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not simply U.S. occupation. Clearly, in bin Laden's case, this is something that's really energized him. But I think the notion that suicide terrorism is always in response to kind of U.S. presence or indeed any democratic army that's presence in occupying a particular country. Mm. I don't think we have a one-size-fits-all theory. And particularly with one that seems to downplay this dimension. I mean, the attack in London was British citizens attacking British targets.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit in really into anything that Professor Pape's theory says, even though Professor Pape's theory is very, very useful, I think, across the board, and is particularly useful in the sense that it says, you know, wait a minute, the Tamil Tigers, who are essentially a Marxist-Leninist group,
Sri Lanka, you know.
Have done more suicide attacks than any other.
I'm sure he would argue with that, but I want to take the conversation, if we could, for a moment, back to London itself. We're joined from London by Michael Goldfarb. He's a WBOR correspondent. He's reported in depth on the jihadi movement inside the UK. Michael, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Michael, what's your sense of how the issues in the Middle East filter into the UK, filter into the hearts and minds, apparently, of these four young men who died last Thursday carrying out terror attacks? What's the mechanism? What's the transfer chain here?
Well, I think that you have to look at the Middle East, first of all, try and see it through the eyes of Muslims. There is, I think, a deep uneasiness and just a sullen anger about what's perceived as Western policy which favors Israel. You can argue whether that's true or not, and you can argue whether the perception is correct or not, but this is how many Muslims feel. But, you know, I think that when you say transfer change, Tom, I think you have to understand that these guys, the young men who went out, I was struck by two things that emerged today. One is apparently as many as three of them recently visited Pakistan for, put it in quotation marks, religious instruction.
Mm-hmm.
The details of where they went, you know, what madrasas they might have attended, I have not come out yet. But I mean, it's in these academies that the very hardline kind of Wahhabi Salafi interpretation of Islam is taught, and young men are actually indoctrinated into this belief that by committing acts of terror, these are acts of jihad, and they will immediately be transported into paradise.
But you've reported, Michael, that you don't have to go to Pakistan to hear that kind of preaching,
no,
that it's right there in the mosques of the UK.
That's the most extraordinary thing is, you know, if you attend any of these talks by, you know, notorious and very public, it should be said, very, very public, teacher like Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad, you know, you hear sedition. I mean, it can only be described as sedition being preached. You are listen to young men learning an interpretation of Quran, which says, "So you're worried about perhaps killing fellow Muslims if you commit go on a suicide mission,"
mm-hmm.
And they're reminded that in the book of life, when your time is come, Allah will take you. He might take you in a car accident. He might take you when you sleep. He might take you, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is the rhetoric that I heard. He might take you because you were in a suicide attack.
You can't get much more explicit in the preaching to go and do it than that.
And the way he avoided arrest was simply by you know, adding a caveat that that he always taught in his circle that because he had been given asylum in Britain, Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad is Syrian born. He fled Syria after several visits to Ba'ath regime jails. He fled to Lebanon. He was expelled from Lebanon. He went to Saudi Arabia. And this is, you know, a Wahhabi teacher. He was expelled from Saudi Arabia.
With the talk of cracking down in the UK today, is he likely to soon be out of the UK or in prison there, or is he still protected by British law?
He would say, well, you know, I have no passport. I'm a stateless person. Where can they deport me? The UK may well try and deport him back to Syria, his native country. But, you know, Tom, I guess the thing is that it's also a youth thing in the Muslim world, and I was listening to Professor Pape talking, and you know, one of the things that we know, but we don't often add into these conversations, is there's been this extraordinary population growth in the Muslim world in general and the Muslim Middle East in particular. And that, and when I say Middle East, I'll extend it into South Asia, to Pakistan as well. More than half the people, if I'm not mistaken, somebody can correct me if my statistics are off, more than half the Muslims there are under the age of 25.
And Peter Bergen reporting just a couple of days ago that 16 to 24-year-old Muslim men in the UK, unemployment rate of 22%. That's got to create some ferment.
It creates ferment, but it also creates opportunity. But we should also remember that the suicide bombers who left Britain and attacked that bar in Tel Aviv more than a year and a half ago were middle class. I mean, they'd gone to good schools. Yeah. They were on university track.
So there they were, a complicated situation, and they weren't necessarily down and out. Michael Goldfarb with WBUR in London, thank you very much for being with us. Robert Pape in Chicago, Peter Bergen in Washington, please stand by. We're talking tonight about homegrown suicide terror in the heart of the West and what it means. You can join the conversation. How much of suicide terror is a security issue and how much a psychological issue? How do we address the latter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about homegrown suicide terror in the heart of the West and what it means. We're joined tonight from Chicago by Robert Pape, professor at the University of Chicago, author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and from Washington by Peter Bergen, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Holy War, Inc. You can join us. Do you agree with Robert Pape that Western troops in the Middle East are the prime provocation to suicide terror? Would a pullout solve the problem? Where would that pullout end? And what about the suicide terror threat here? Is the U.S. different? Is the U.S. next? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sandra's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Sandra, what do you think?
I think the professor's argument is, I don't understand how he came to that conclusion. It just doesn't seem logical to me. We can't pull out of Iraq as long as there are suicide bombings going on. So to say that they're doing the suicide bombing so that we'll pull out, it makes it sound like they can't even make a simple logical conclusion.
It sounds upside down and backwards to you, but he says he's looked at the numbers and that these things happen where foreign troops, U.S. troops, are on the ground. Clearly there have been 500, I'm reading today in the New York Times, 500 suicide bombings in Iraq as opposed to none before. So that kind of goes along with his formula, doesn't it?
But I agree with what that previous caller said. He said we have American troops on the ground all over the world, and there's not suicide bombers going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that argument just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I think it's just like, you know, the other alternative that you mentioned. It's a psychological issue. I don't think it has anything to do with. I think it's just.
How do you address the psychological issue if it's not Robert Pape's solution, if it's not pulling the troops offshore? What approach do you suggest, Sandra?
I wish I knew. I don't have any idea.
Yep. Sandra, thanks for your call. Peter Bergen, how about it? To get at the motivation, it sounds like you and Robert Pape are not exactly on the same page, but clearly these four guys in the UK, it's not because they're looking out their door and seeing U.S. troops. There's a huge psychological piece to it. How do you get at that?
Well, certainly, you know, if you look at terrorism figures, I mean, Donald Rumsfeld famously complained, what's the metric how are we winning or losing? What are the metrics? Well, there's one very good metric I can suggest, which is terrorism figures. 2003 saw the worst number of significant terrorist attacks for two decades. And then, astonishingly, the numbers then tripled in 2004. So we're seeing, you know, a hell of a lot of terrorism right at the same time that we have occupied Iraq. And I think there is some kind of connection between these two things, clearly. Maybe from an intellectual point of view, it makes sense to pull out. On the other hand, you know, we seem to have stirred up such a hornet's nest in Iraq. It would, I think, you know, be profoundly irresponsible to sort of act like Pontius Pilate and simply wash our hands of the situation. So we're sort of, I mean, I have no good answers either. It's we seem to have got ourselves into a huge pickle, and I don't see anybody on either side of the political spectrum really articulating a particularly a policy which kind of makes sense.
But 500 of these bombings in Iraq, it's an incredible number. And, of course, a very big one today, U.S. soldiers handing out candy. A truck comes slamming into the Humvee, and 27 Iraqis, one U.S. soldier, Iraqi children largely killed there. I mean, this is bad. Can you see this becoming endemic in the West as a security challenge, Peter Bergen? Is this going to stay the rarity, or?
You know, I can't really predict the future, but I mean, the fact is that we're seeing a trend. You know, I mentioned earlier in the program, British suicide attackers in Israel, now inside Britain itself, attempted suicide attack on an American airline. But I mean, there is a trend line developing here, and I think that we'll probably see more of this rather than less of it in the future.
Ahmed is calling from Boston. Hello, Ahmed. You're on the air.
Hello, my name is Ahmed. Hi, how are we doing today?
Good. What do you think, Ahmed? How do you interpret this?
I think it's not in the Quran. You cannot kill yourself, to kill innocent people. Like, if anyone, try to translate something in the Quran, you get the Quran and translate everything. But you cannot get just the meaning of one. You can, in the Quran, say, protect your house, protect your home. Mm-hmm. You can die if someone try to attack you in your home.
And yet you know the Quran is being used to promote jihad in even suicide terror in any number of countries now. So what do you make of that?
Well, I make a point, you cannot kill innocent people.
But they're being killed. They've been killed. They were killed on Thursday in London. The kids were killed in Iraq today. So
yes, we don't consider them Muslims. We don't consider them Muslims.
Can I intervene here? Because I think it's very important.
Peter Bergen, please.
The Quran is full of injunctions about protecting civilians, protecting trees, roads, all these things. So, when Bin Laden is asked the question, how do you justify the killing of innocent civilians? Because he's been asked by a couple of journalists. The usually rather eloquent terrorist leader becomes rather mealy-mouthed, and he resorts to the following justification. Well, American taxpayers subsidize American foreign policy.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, the Quran doesn't have anything to say about American taxpayers or American foreign policy, and so he's basically stumped. And we have a very important, I think, something we can really exploit, which is we should always say, when these things happen, our political leaders should say, this is against the Quran, this is against Islam. You don't have to be an Islamic expert to say these things. And we should also say that this is a group that has been particularly successful at one thing, which is killing fellow Muslims. I can guarantee you that a disproportionate number of Muslims died in London. One of the bombs went off in the Edgware Road area, which is essentially an Arab street.
Yes.
And we should really harp on this.
Ahmed, let me ask you, how do you suggest that the government in the UK, in the U.S., respond to this? What's the best way to tamp this down?
The best way to do it, to start from over here, to start from everywhere, try to catch the terrorists, try to catch who try to blend anything like that, try to catch them.
Just catch them. Go and catch them. But it's hard to catch so many. Ahmed, thanks for your call. Let's get another call here. John is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How do you do?
Very well. What do you think, John?
Well, actually, what I think is that at the base of the problem is the conflict between Islam and the West. And it's a point that I think often isn't presented because we people tend to go for political correctness. But I actually feel that in a way you could say World War III has already started, and that's between Islam and the West. And we could trace how did it start, how did it come. But the point is the ball is rolling, and I really don't see...
But that sounds so apocalyptic, John, and surely many Muslims don't want to enter into that kind of conflict. Obviously, most people in the UK and the US don't want to get into some kind of apocalyptic meltdown conflict with Islam. Aren't we smart enough to work our way out of something like that?
Well, I mean, if you look at Europe and how the Muslims who go into Europe are not mixing with the culture, and then in, say, 50 years, if they have the majority, then can change it into an Islamic society. I just think that in very practical ways, I don't think that politicians are taking appropriate steps. For example, in Europe, a solution I would think is reasonable is closing off the border, not letting Turkey into the EU to protect the Western societies where women have freedom. I think we owe it to the planet to protect these democracies.
So you're saying keep the populations apart, and yet in a globalized time, it's awfully hard to do that. But, John, thank you very much for your call. Robert Pape, you've been listening for a while there. Your
I guess
thoughts.
I've been letting all the charges mount.
Yeah, well, the charges mount. Your solution is get the troops out. You hear the caller saying, come on, we're in the thick of this. And Peter Bergen, in a way, is saying the same. You know, it may have been a good idea, but it's too late now. We're up to our hips here. What do you do?
Well, first of all, let me say a couple of quick things and then respond to a couple of things Peter said. I'm not calling for some reckless withdrawal of all troops by tomorrow. Nothing of the sort. I believe we should try to move to offshore balancing over a 3 or 4 year period. Yes, we should take some very specific steps to transfer responsibility for the Iraqi government, for the responsibility of security of Iraq to the Iraqi government in the next 12 months. But no one, at least of all, I'm not calling for some reckless pullout to abandon Iraq. After all, I want to have a stable Iraq to form an alliance with.
But you are saying 3 or 4 years, and Don Rumsfeld has said 2012, so there is a different time frame here.
Yes, there's differences, but I mean, the main point is I'm not calling for some reckless pullout.
Got it. We've just got a minute. Take us on to your bottom line.
Well, the other point is many powers have asked, or Peter's asked, aren't there other conditions in addition to the necessary condition of foreign troops on territory that the terrorists prize? And the answer is yes. Dying to Win lays out what those other conditions are, and I really don't have time to go through them. I wish I did, but the fact is there are other things. So, no, I'm not.
Name a couple.
Prior rebellion and a religious difference. Those are the two primary conditions laid out in three chapters of the book, well-developed, and I wish I had time to go through them, but it would take us too far away. The main point that Peter made, I have no disagreement that there is a transnational appeal to al-Qaeda. I'm not denying. In fact, I'm trying to define it more precisely.
Mm-hmm.
By looking at the 71 al-Qaeda suicide attackers who actually did the mission from 95 to 2004, two-thirds came from Muslim countries where we stationed combat troops. One-third did not. And I said specifically these four fit in the one-third category that did not. But even these four, based on the only statement we have at the moment, that is the al-Qaeda claim that came on Thursday, appear to have been at least partly, if not mainly, motivated by opposition to British military policies, because the statement does not say this is an effort to for Muslims to convert Christians. It does not say this is an effort for us to get to heaven. What it says specifically is this is punishment for Britain's military operations in Iraq, and then it goes on to threaten Italy and Denmark that unless they withdraw their forces, they too will be hit. And the fact is, I'm not claiming that this is all there is to al-Qaeda, but if al-Qaeda could not recruit suicide terrorists from the Muslim countries where we station combat forces, the remaining transnational network would pose a far smaller threat, may well simply collapse or not even form at all. Mm-hmm. Had we not had troops in the Persian Gulf, it may well be the case these four individuals would never have done the suicide attack that they did in London.
And with that, we're out of time. Robert Pape, author of the new book, Dying to Win, at the University of Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Peter Bergen, author of Holy War, Inc., at the New America Foundation, thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers is sentenced to 25 years in prison. This is On Point. After a 9-week trial, a federal judge today sentenced former WorldCom CEO Bernie Ebbers to 25 years in prison for spearheading an $11 billion fraud, the largest accounting fraud in U.S. history. Throughout his trial, Ebbers maintained he was not aware of the fraud at WorldCom, the company he founded and led. Today, Ebbers dabbed his eyes and his wife, Christy Ebbers, wept when the sentence came down. The 63-year-old Ebbers reports to prison on October 12th. Earlier this week, a judge approved a settlement in a civil lawsuit brought by WorldCom investors that requires Ebbers to pay $5 million and hand over nearly all of his assets. Although Ebbers faces a bleak future, shareholders were the biggest financial losers when WorldCom, once worth $180 billion, went into bankruptcy in 2002 because of the accounting scandal. Steve Rosenbusch has been following the trial for Businessweek magazine and was in court today. He joins me now. Steve, thanks for joining us. What was the paint a picture for us of the moment of sentencing here? That's a big sentence.
It was a grim day for Evers, and I think for everyone in the court. This is someone who was extremely proud and I would say almost defiant right up until the end. He walked around the courtroom in March with a cigar clamped between his teeth and his hands on his hips. And by the time he faced Judge Barbara Jones in court today, his elbows were on the table, his hands were clasped together, almost as if they were in prayer, and perhaps they were, and he was wiping his eyes with a tissue.
Judge Jones, Barbara Jones, saying today, "I find that a sentence of anything less would not reflect the seriousness of this crime." Can you describe for us what is it that she's pushing back against with this stiff sentence? Not as large as it could be, but it was 80-some years possible, and he's 63 years old, so I guess even this could look like a life sentence, but still, that's about as bad as it can get. What's she pushing back against exactly?
Well, she's pushing back against... First of all, she's trying to send a message that fraud won't be tolerated, and maybe it's an obvious message, but it needs to be made again and again because memories, certainly on Wall Street, aren't very long. She's pushing back against the idea that CEOs can just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, "I don't know. I didn't order my direct reports to do this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I don't even really understand what they did. That's just not good enough." And there's something new about that, you know, that defense might have worked a few years ago. And I think that she was just also pushing back on the idea that Evers is innocent. He's maintained his innocence to this day. His attorneys have been extremely aggressive about proclaiming his innocence, and it was very obvious to me in court today that she just did not buy that at all. She believes he's guilty, and at one point I thought it was very interesting that she said explicitly, "It's very clear to me that Mr. Evers played a leading role in the crimes that were committed in this case."
Steve, you work at Business Week. A lot of CEOs and corporate executives will be looking at this tonight. This was a tall tree in the forest, so much ink in the 1990s. How is this likely, the impact of this, likely to flow through into business operations in American corporations? Can you imagine a real material sort of train of consequences from this?
I can imagine it. You know, I think that a lot of people assume that this will have a really big short-term impact and that 2 years from now that the people won't really remember it that vividly. But I'm not so sure. During the 90s, it was really assumed that the CEO's job was to put the company's finances and its prospects and its future in the best possible light, essentially to spin the company's story to Wall Street and to the media and to investors in general. And I think that idea is actually going to have to change. Because it's a very fine line between putting a company's prospects in their best possible light and lying to investors or saying something that's just so egregiously wrong that that it's almost like lying. So I think that it may, in fact, over time lead to more honest communication.
Where is Bernie Ebers going to spend his sentence? Do you know?
Looks like he will be in Yazoo, Mississippi, which is about 50 miles from his home. Now, given the length of his sentence, he was actually headed to a medium security facility, and even the prosecutors in this case really, that was more than they could stomach. So it seems like the judge is going to clear the way for him to be in a low or minimum security part of that facility in Yazoo.
63 years old, a 25-year sentence. That's a long time. Steve Rosenbusch, senior writer at Business Week, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.